This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the things we learned about Walter Scott, the man who was fatally shot in the back by a South Carolina police officer in March, he had an outstanding warrant for his arrest. The charge? Failure to pay child support, for which he had already been jailed. Family members say he may well have fled from North Charleston officer Michael Slager because he didn't want to go to jail for his debt again. Currently, 1/8 of South Carolina inmates are serving time for failure to pay child support. Thousands of other parents in other states are being jailed, having wages garnished, or have had their driver's licenses revoked over child support violations. Shyla Dewan covers cities and states for the New York Times. She and Frances Robles wrote about punitive policies for child support that some critics charge is keeping poor men trapped in a cycle of debt, unemployment, and prison. And Shyla Dewan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So first to Walter Scott's case. He was a father of four kids by two women. He had been previously jailed for his debt.
That's right. He had been jailed several times for failure to pay child support. Sometimes he spent months in jail, and sometimes he got out fairly quickly after he made a lump sum payment or his parents made a lump sum payment on his behalf.
Now, how much did he owe when he was stopped for the broken taillight?
He owed about $18,000.
Wow, that's a lot. Was he employed at that time?
He was employed. He had been employed for about 6 months, and we are not sure why his wages were not being garnished for child support. Normally, that is an automatic thing that happens whenever anyone who has a child support order is employed. It's automatically deducted.
But we don't know if he was actually paying or if the amount exceeded his pay at that time.
We don't know.
Okay. So was there any signs that he was making good faith efforts to pay his child support?
The picture is pretty murky with Scott. And there's just, he can't speak for himself, so there's a lot we don't know. He had made payments in the past. He had made both the paycheck deduction payments and lump sum payments. Sometimes he made those payments under threat of incarceration. And we just don't know exactly what the situation was when he was killed, whether he had been completely shirking or whether he had some financial pressures we don't know about or what exactly was going on.
He had, at some point in the past, been enrolled in some kind of program to encourage dads to pay. So, you know, let's be clear, not giving the man a pass, but not altogether the picture of what you might call a deadbeat dad.
He was not, in my opinion, a deadbeat dad. I mean, we have this specter. Remember in the 80s and 90s, we learned about deadbeat dads who were just, you know, like watching their cable TV on their big sectional couch while the mother of their children struggled to get by and put food on the table. That doesn't seem to be what was going on in this case.
Mm-hmm. How is payment compelled? You mentioned garnishing wages.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of ways. So in the late 90s, at about the same time that welfare was reformed, they also put in place a whole bunch of child support enforcement measures to combat this very problem that we're talking about, the deadbeat dad, and also to change the attitude. There was sort of a pervasive attitude that, you know, men could sort of get away with it, they weren't responsible, and that attitude had changed, and they wanted to make sure people paid. And so they did a lot of automating of the system. so that they could automatically withhold money. And that's not actually a garnishment. Like, if you're just paying what you owe, that's not considered a garnishment. That's just withholding the money directly from your paycheck so you don't have to sit down and write that check mm-hmm. every month. It goes directly to the mom. And then there were some more punitive measures, suspending your driver's license if you didn't pay, withholding your passport or not allowing a passport renewal if you didn't pay, and then you could be held in contempt of court and sent to jail for not paying.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke to a truck driver for your article mm-hmm. who was about to get his license revoked, which would mean that he would be unemployed. Now, you quote some critics of these kind of policies in your articles who say that they are especially hard on the poor. What are they saying?
Well, it starts when the child support order is set by the judge. And it looks like from the data we have that a lot of times the child support order is itself unaffordable from the outset for a poor parent who may be unemployed or underemployed. And sometimes if the judge doesn't know exactly what the situation is or if they just feel like it, they will say, you know, well, you know, if you were working 40 hours a week at minimum wage, you'd be making this much. And so we're going to charge you this much for child support. And the person isn't working 40 hours a week and probably would have a very hard time finding a job, or they may have significant barriers to employment, like a prison record or a lack of a high school degree. And so from the outset, they owe something every month that they can't pay.
Mm-hmm. So once you go to prison for this, you know, you've got a prison record and it may be harder to get a job. Reading here a 2007 Urban Institute studying of child support debt in 9 states, 70% of the arrears were owed by people who reported less than $10,000 a year in income.
Right.
Now, in the case of Walter Scott, he lost a couple of good jobs to do jail time, and he told his brother he resented having to pay when his one of two mothers of his children were getting support from welfare. Is that common?
Yes. Well, this is this thing that I didn't realize at all, actually. But so when a single mom goes on welfare, they assign their right to collect child support to the state, and the state turns around and goes after the other parent and says, we're paying welfare for your children who you're not supporting, so you pay us back for the welfare.
Now, see, I had no idea that was happening.
And many, many, many child support cases, and especially among the poor, the majority of the money collected is going back to welfare. So, and there are varying, some states will pass through some of that money directly to the kids, even though the debt is owed to welfare, but every state has a different policy on that. So it is interesting because that makes the father less likely to pay if we're talking about arrearages where they know the money's not going to their kids. And you're also talking about, well, the woman qualifies, it's often a mother, I should say, not always, for welfare support. The father may be just as poor, but instead he's having to pay back the welfare support.
Mm.
And we should say, of course, that parents are responsible for supporting and taking care of their children, but I think Mr. Scott saw this as an imbalance or an unfairness, whereas he was being held accountable, and in his view, she was not.
Right. I'm speaking with Shyla Dewan of the New York Times, and she wrote an article about very strict punitive measures for parents who fail to pay child support. Policies that some critics charge as keeping poor men trapped in a cycle of debt and unemployment and prison. Well, of course, men who do not pay for their kids are not the most sympathetic of characters.
Absolutely not.
But there are some cases now challenging the punitive measures that keep this cycle, if you will, going. What can you tell us about the nature of progress of these cases?
Well, many of them have been unsuccessful or of mixed success, I should say. There was a big case in Georgia that was seeking primarily the right to counsel. So when the judge says you're not paying child support, go to jail, that's not a criminal proceeding. That's a civil contempt proceeding. And so you're not entitled to a lawyer, even though you're facing jail. About half of states do provide a lawyer in that situation, but they don't have to according to the Constitution. And so there was a big case in Georgia. The Georgia Supreme Court said these parents do not have a categorical right to be represented. Then there was a Supreme Court case, actually predating the Georgia case, there was a Supreme Court case that came out of South Carolina. Same issue, the man was facing jail in a civil contempt hearing, did not have a lawyer, and the Supreme Court said he was not entitled to a lawyer because the mother, who was opposing him, did not have a lawyer. But it didn't say what happens in a case where the state is the other party, which, as we've already established, often it's the state going mm-hmm. after you for welfare repayment. So the Supreme Court was silent as to whether you should have a lawyer in a case where you're opposed by the state, who obviously has a lawyer.
Well, it sounds like a big problem. Are there any advocates, policymakers, social service agencies considering new formulas or other ways to ensure support for families?
Well, I think you're seeing, if you talk to the Child Support Enforcement Agency group, they will tell you there's been a lot of improvement in this and a change of focus to, you know, helping the other parent become more productive, helping them stay employed and all of that. But you have to realize that the federal child support system is set up to incentivize these collection agencies to have more cases. They get rewarded for the number of cases they have, the number of orders for support that they get established. And so there's no incentive for them to only go after non-custodial parents who actually have money. They have the incentive to go after everyone. The Obama administration has proposed some rulemaking that would change some of the more egregious practices, and they have also discouraged the use of civil contempt in these cases. There are other options available. You don't have to send someone to jail. So, and there's another aspect of this, which is some states, when you go to prison or to jail, they continue to let your child support accrue because they consider you voluntarily unemployed during that time. So the Obama administration wants to end that practice, so at least you're not racking up debt. So when you get out of prison, you'll owe thousands of dollars. This debt, by the way, is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. So it can be like a forever debt. If you come out of prison owing $40,000 in child support, that will follow you throughout your life. And I should say, too, that some advocates have said that this actually adversely impacts the kids.
Right.
I mean, there are all kinds of issues, but it does tend to drive the non-custodial parent underground into the underground economy, and it may discourage him from visiting his kids because then he can be found. It may discourage him from doing anything where he can be found if he has a warrant out for his arrest. And it also creates a situation where the father is unable to build assets. If you deposit money in a bank account and that money is instantly seized for child support debt, you can't save up to, say, buy a car or save up for college tuition or things that may enable you to become a better producer for your family and better able to support them. So it does impact families and children in ways that maybe we don't think about when we just think, you know, this guy owes this money to the mom, and he should be paying it.
Shyla Dewan covers cities and states for the New York Times. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks.
Shyla co-wrote an article for the New York Times called Skip Child Support, Go to Jail, Lose Job, Repeat. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. Don your armor and prepare to wield your battle axe. When Word of Mouth returns, we'll enter the world of competitive medieval combat and find out why Nashua, New Hampshire has become a hotbed for would-be knights. That's after a quick break. This Thursday, a global sporting event you've probably never heard of will take place at the historic Malbork Castle in Poland, the Medieval Combat World Championships. Wearing full suits of armor and wielding blunted axes and swords, international contestants will compete in a variety of full contact events. Many members of the U.S. team train at the Knights Hall. That's an armored combat gym in Nashua, New Hampshire. Earlier this month, producer Taylor Quimby joined them for one of their last training sessions before the World Championships.
Arm cramping up.
With the World Championships just around the corner, Jay Brooks, senior instructor and owner of the Knights Hall, doesn't want to risk any late-in-the-game injuries.
Guys, ready for another set?
Usually, his team members would be practicing judo throws and boxing drills, wearing some 70-odd pounds of armor. But today, these six men take turns beating on car tires with two-handed axes.
Hey. Collarbone!
We're not just, you know, running around pretending we're knights. You know, what we're doing is full contact, full force fighting. It's MMA with weapons.
While Renaissance fairs have been popular for decades, armored or medieval combat has only been around for a few years, and the Knights Hall in Nashua is currently the only full-time training facility devoted to the sport.
Right now, being in New Hampshire or, you know, New England is the place to be. We've got enough experience and enough guys that are motivated to have competitions every couple of weeks. As far as the United States goes, this is a hotbed.
Live free or die, right?
Live free or die, that's right. And these guys are, you know, into their swords and axes. We've got a lot of really good axemen here, too.
The main workout area, which doubles as an exhibition hall, looks like a medieval CrossFit gym. The center arena is lined by steel guardrails. A small set of bleachers sits to one side behind a mesh fence. And about a dozen weapons hang on the wall. Not the stylized blades we're used to seeing in films like The Hobbit or in Game of Thrones. These are plain and pragmatic instruments of war. The sport is divided into two types of events. One-on-one duels, which operate using a point system similar to boxing. And then there are the melees, group battles of 3-on-3, 5-on-5, 10-on-10, 16-on-16, or all-on-all.
In this sport, the goal when you're doing the team fighting is to get a guy to the ground. And you can do that, you know, by submission, or you can do it by driving them to the earth.
Videos from competitions held at the Knights Hall showed just how intensely physical these events are. In one clip, a fully armored Jay Brooks swings a two-handed axe so hard into the helmet of another fighter, the collision produces a shower of sparks and sends him sprawling to the floor. Incredibly, the sport doesn't see that many serious injuries.
You do get some bruising and banging, and you're hitting with real weapons, but you're wearing armor, and you're wearing armor that has to meet specific standards. So you're going to work on Monday. Right, you're going to be okay for Monday, even though you just got hit in the head with a real battle axe.
Go.
So we're doing half steps first?
Half steps.
After giving the tires a thorough beating, Jay's students practice their footwork, pointing their weapons slightly forward as they take small, quick steps across the room.
And if someone takes themselves out of guard while they're doing it, take a little whack at their arm.
Andrew Jefferson teaches Taekwondo in Goffstown, New Hampshire, and has 24 years of experience in the martial arts. He joined the Knights Hall in November and is currently working on assembling his own kit of armor.
So when we have unarmored martial arts, like Eastern martial arts, we tend to use really wide stances or at least a little bit wider than our shoulders. Here it's like very specific. You train shoulders width and you have to watch where your shoulders go, because if you get knocked the wrong way, you're going to fall over.
All right, guys who have armor.
After drills, the group moves on to another essential part of armored combat. An inventory of everything they're going to need to compete in the world championships.
I'm guessing that if you were to forget something on this trip...
It would be tragic.
The men who are going to Poland lay their armor out on the floor of the gym. Jay uses a powerful rare earth magnet to make sure every piece is made of steel. Judges in Poland will do the same thing, checking to make sure none of their armor is forged from titanium.
These were pressed, which is why they're not as...
At the flutes, though, you could feel it.
Yeah, wherever they were worked... It changes the crystalline structure on the steel.
While the brutality of weapon fighting may shock casual observers, it's the armor that clearly sets this sport apart. Not only does it determine the strategy of the fighters, the visual aesthetic makes for an awesome spectacle. And the high price tag makes the financial cost of knighthood impossible to ignore.
Yeah, I probably spent $2,500 to $3,000 on my armor so far, which is dirt cheap for most kits.
That's Brandon Ross, who started working out at the Knights Hall in June and will be competing in the 10-on-10 melee event at the World Championships.
The guys that bought them new from Ice Falcon Armory, $7,000, $9,000. So it's a pretty tough investment.
Add to that the cost of a week-long trip to Poland, and you've got a very expensive sport. Just ask Evan Ringo of Concord, New Hampshire.
We're broke. We, you know, Lane took out a credit card just to pay for this. I pulled money out of my 401k. Brandon built his by himself. So
yeah.
That means fighters can't afford to simply replace equipment that gets banged out of shape. So right outside the main gym is a long hallway where they can fix their own armor.
He's cutting out a little rivet, and then he's got to hammer it in, cut off a little bit of the copper, and then peen it down so it doesn't stab him in the leg. It's an intense little process.
While the financial investment required of these athletes may prevent casual observers from joining in, there is a powerful upside. For these men, armored combat isn't just a sport, it's a lifestyle. Here's Lane Adderidge of Billerica, Massachusetts.
If you want to get into this sport, you see it and you catch like that fever, you find a way to get armor. Like, you really, really find a way.
Some of these knights, who caught the fever and haven't looked back, will be defending gold medals at the World Championships, which begin this Thursday. Others will be going for the first time and looking to leave a lasting legacy. All they have left to do is pack.
I think we're going to bring the golf bag this year, the hard case golf bag in the other room, and that might fit long swords and everything in it.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
You can find more about the Knights Hall in Nashua and see some pictures and videos from armored combat competitions. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. We've also posted a link to the website for the International Medieval Combat Championships so you can track how the American team is doing this weekend. Heart, smiley face, thumbs up, rain cloud, chicken wing. Up next on Word of Mouth, a look at emoji use around the world and why Canada leads in raunchy pictographs. That's after a quick break.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The closest thing to modern-day hieroglyphics, emoji, once just added for comic or emotional embellishment, are now part of how the world communicates. And like language, reflect national culture and identity. But what exactly do they reveal? Does emoji use change from country to country? Well, the mobile app company SwiftKey recently conducted a wide-reaching study on how emoji are used across the world and analyzed more than a billion pieces of emoji data. Jennifer Kutz is head of communications for SwiftKey and joins us now to discuss the findings. Jennifer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Which emoji are the most popular worldwide?
Smiley faces, by far. So there's, as anyone who's used emoji will know, there's many, many variations of a smiley emoji, and we categorize them as either happy or sad, and the angry goes in the sad group. 44.8% of all emoji used fall into the happy emoji category.
How much does it vary worldwide? Which smiley faces are chosen and which others?
Sure. So it does vary somewhat. The only language out of the 16 we studied for this report that did not have a smiley face emoji in the number one spot for overall usage in the language is French. They actually are very unique. Yes, in that over half of the emoji they send are hearts, which we were pretty shocked by initially. U.S. Spanish uses the most sad faces, and Turkish uses the most smiley faces on average.
Well, that's so fascinating. What about Americans in general? Which emoji strike our fancy?
So Americans, didn't actually stick out in huge ways like the French do, or, you know, the Arabics use flowers and plants significantly more than every other language. We did stick out in a few kind of key categories. We do use the most LGBT emoji, and for that category, we put, there's two emoji that Apple created. One is women holding hands, one is men holding hands. We also put the rainbow emoji there. We use that 30% more than any other language. We also lead for kind of stereotypically female-oriented emoji. So the pink bow, the lipstick, painting fingernails, that's the category we lead for, as well as meat. So there's
meat.
Meat. Yes, there is a drumstick and some other sort of ambiguous looking meat with bone on it, and we leave for both of those.
The U.S. also leads in the use of the eggplant. What's the deal there? Is there something I'm not getting?
So it's only recently emerged. Just before this report, actually, we saw some media coverage on the eggplant emoji is being used in ways that it was probably not intended. I will leave that to your imagination, but it's probably not a far guess from what you're thinking.
Well, I guess eggplants are big in Canada as well. Now, our neighbors to the north apparently have a fondness for slightly off-colored emoji.
Indeed, yes. Canada's beat us in many categories we thought Americans would win for. So some of these include the poop emoji, which we were really hoping that Americans would win for, but they did not. So that was quite funny. They use it double the average and significantly ahead of Americans as well. They also lead for, you know, several things, including violent emoji, in which we put the knife, gun, the death skull and the bomb and that sort of a thing. Raunchy emoji. So I mentioned the eggplant. We created a category of emoji that we know are often used in ways they probably weren't designed to be, including cherries, the cancer symbol, which looks like two numbers, the peach. They use that double the average rate. They also use three times more sports emoji than the average.
Okay, so how about some other countries? Australia, Brazil, any biggies there?
Yeah, so Australia was also an interesting one in that they really seem to be a place where people indulge in a lot of vice and sort of traditionally sinful living. So they use a lot of alcohol emoji, so they lead in that category. So the wine, the cocktail, the beers. They use 65% more drugs emoji. They also lead for junk food and holidays. One other interesting thing is they lead in the mammal category, and that it seems to be because they use the rabbit emoji very often. And we heard from an Australian recently that that could be because the time period that we looked at emoji was over 4 months over the new year, where they had I think it was a football tournament, and the leading team, that's their mascot, was a rabbit.
You know, what are emoji telling us about how people truly communicate and what they value?
You know, we would love to do a little more research here, because at this point, some of this is really just speculation. But I think it's interesting. For French, because they use so many hearts, it tended to make them under index for many different categories. So I would guess that probably what that is about. For Vietnam, you know, it's hard to say. I don't know a lot about the LGBTQ culture there, but it could say something about that. Maybe it's something that people don't talk about as much, or maybe they have different ways of talking about it. You know, like we use certain emoji for different reasons. Maybe they have the same thing. You know, I think it does indicate here that these are, you know, emoji that we want to use, and we're probably using them for that reason in America.
Well, SwiftKey's really hit on something here doing this survey of emoji. Where do you think the emoji's going, Jennifer?
I think it is going to quickly evolve to be a lot more customized. I think we're seeing some of this, you know, on the iPhone. There's a lot of new abilities for you to build in GIFs and, you know, different stickers that you can send. It's just a much easier way to express what you're feeling. And I think we've all sort of, you know, if you've used email in your job or in your personal life, I think we've all had those experiences where people misinterpret your tone or your sentiment, because it's very hard to communicate that just through words. It can come across kind of more stoic. Whereas with emoji, it's much easier. And so I see that just becoming more and more popular.
Well, Jennifer Kutz, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jennifer Kutz, she's head of communications for SwiftKey. That's a mobile keyboard app, which recently conducted a study of emoji use from around the world. You'll find a link to read the study at wordofmouthradio.org. Rioting broke out in West Baltimore yesterday after the funeral service for Freddie Gray, who died of a spinal cord injury 10 days ago while in police custody. Last night's clashes were the most widespread since 1968, when the city went through 8 days of protests and looting following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our next story looks back to April the 5th of 1968. That's the day after King's assassination. Riots were taking over urban centers across the country, and many more cities were teetering on the edge of chaos. In Boston, James Brown was scheduled to play to a sold-out crowd at the 14,000-seat Boston Garden. The concert had the potential to be a flashpoint for an uprising in the heart of downtown Boston. Michael May brings us the story.
Music journalist Tom Vickers was one of the few white people with a ticket to the James Brown concert that night. He was 18 years old at the time. He grew up in Boston and was a huge fan of R&B. He was well aware of just how much tension there was between whites and blacks in the city. For the most part, whites stayed in South Boston, and blacks stayed in a neighborhood called Roxbury.
If you were a black person and you were found on the streets of South Boston, day or night, you know, you were lucky to escape alive. And quite frankly, the inverse was true. If you were a white person walking the streets of Roxbury, there was danger. You know, you could feel it. It was palpable.
The tension had been escalating in the mid-60s as the city began to desegregate its public schools. The mayoral race in 1967 pitted a liberal reformer, Kevin White, against Louise Day Hicks, an opponent of desegregation. Hicks ran under the evasive slogan, "You know where I stand." White won the race by less than 12,000 votes. So Boston's race relations were already on a short fuse when Martin Luther King was shot and killed on April 4th, 1968. John Jabbo Starks, the drummer in James Brown's band, was heading into town to play the Boston Gardens when he heard the news.
That was such a tragedy. It was sad, and then it was shameful. It was like almost like as if you were drained. We're trying to better ourselves, and then this happens.
Riots broke out across the country, and some feared Boston would be next. Tom Vickers remembered there was some rioting in Roxbury Friday night that was quickly stopped.
Yet there was this ongoing fear that there would be mass rioting in Boston, that, you know, the African-American community would spread into these various communities in Boston and just tear up the place.
In fact, city leaders were terrified that the James Brown concert would bring the violence right into the heart of downtown. Mayor Kevin White and Boston's first black city council member, Thomas Atkins, debated whether or not to cancel the concert. They talked about the decision in a VH1 documentary. Mayor Kevin White speaks first.
His concert, we thought, might bring as many as 15 or 20,000 black people from the community, particularly young people, into the city. It just had too much emotion in it not to decide whether that would be a problem.
And I said, "Kevin, you are doing exactly the wrong thing. If the word gets out in the black community that the city would not let James Brown come to town and perform in the wake of King's assassination," I said, "all hell will break loose."
The city had only a few hours to find a compromise. Meanwhile, Tom Vickers went to a somber memorial for Dr. King that afternoon in Government Center near downtown. Afterwards, he went to the Boston Gardens and asked a large Irish policeman if the show was still going to happen.
And he said, "Yeah, it's going to happen, but if I were you, I'd just turn in your tickets and get a refund." And I said, "Well, if the show's going to happen, why would I want to do that?" And he said, "Well, it could be a little edgy here tonight, and here's the good news. They're going to show the concert tonight on WGBH. They're going to broadcast the entire show."
The mayor held a press conference to encourage people to stay home and watch it in the safety of their living room. Vickers cashed in his tickets at the box office, as did thousands of others.
Give another round of applause for James Brown.
That night, around 9 p.m., James Brown walked on stage at the Boston Gardens, and Mayor White was by his side. White addressed the crowd of around 2,000 and the row of television cameras.
"Now I'm here tonight, like all of you, to listen to James. But I'm also here to ask for your help. I'm here to ask you to stay with me as your mayor and to make Dr. King's dreams a reality in Boston.
"
This is our city, and its future is in our hands. Tonight, tomorrow, and the days that follow. So all I ask you tonight is this. Well, let us look at each other, here in the gardens and back at home, and pledge that no matter what any other community might do, we in Boston will honor Dr. King in peace. Thank you.
And with that, James Brown, dressed in all black, grabs the microphone and takes over.
I want you to know! Ain't no sin, because I'm writing with my friends. My friends. My friends. To do it all over again. But that's life.
Jabbo Starks was on the drums. He said as soon as he dug into the groove, the intense sadness he was feeling just lifted.
I love to play. Any problems, anything that I've had is vented because I don't hear, see, or think of anything else except I'm playing that music. It's a relief for me.
Tom Vickers and his family crowded around the TV set in their living room and watched in amazement.
James Brown always gave everything, but at this show, there was an emotional edge to it, and he just seemed totally present in the moment, on fire, and giving 110%.
Help me now.
Then, just as James Brown dons his golden cape, a young man jumps on stage, and in an instant, a white police officer rushes in and throws the man back into the audience.
Wait a minute.
It looks like the beginning of a riot that the entire city of Boston will witness on TV.
When they came on stage, they was just, I think they were just venting that anger or something out, and they just wanted to get up and be close to him or get close to whatever. However the mind was going, I can't say, but I know that when the police started trying to throw him off stage, that's when it became a little touchy there.
Brown tells the police officers to let him handle it, and he shakes hands with another teenager who's jumped on stage. Suddenly, fans swarmed the singer.
It was almost to a point that it was getting ready to be something really bad to happen.
We're black. Don't make us all look bad. Let me finish doing the show.
But when he stopped it, he saw that, he stopped it, and he could do that. He had that kind of power. People would listen to him.
Within a couple of minutes, the Godfather of Soul clears the stage.
Now, I asked the police to step back because I figured I could get some respect for my own people. That makes sense. And are we together, we? Yeah. Hit the thing, man.
That night, there was rioting in over 100 U.S. cities. Dozens of people were killed. Huge areas of Newark, Detroit, and Washington, D.C. went up in flames. But Boston remained quiet. People stayed inside their homes, captivated by the James Brown Show. I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
Rube Goldberg's name has become synonymous with machines and processes that deliberately complicate simple tasks. But few know much about the man the contraptions were named for. Up next, word of mouth uncovers the surprisingly dark world of the Rube Goldberg machine. That's after a quick break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
We have candy falling into a jack-o'-lantern. A bus hits a ghost, which pulls a string, which pours candy into a jack-o'-lantern. Just about everything that could go wrong with that has gone wrong. We have rebuilt that jack-o'-lantern probably dozens of times. And every time that we would reset up the machine, something would move. Like the back wall would tilt just the slightest bit, and we'd have to redo it all again.
That was Penn State engineering student Rebecca Tarosky describing the quirky machine that she and her team built for the 2015 Rube Goldberg Machine Contest College Nationals back in March. The goal of the contest? To build an overly complex, elaborate contraption that utilizes at least 20 steps to achieve a very simple task. This year's task was to get the machine to erase a chalkboard. Rube Goldberg's name is often used to symbolize complex bureaucracies and overly elaborate ways of getting things done. But few know much about the man they were named for. Brendan O'Connor is a freelance journalist based in New York, and we found his article Inside the Surprisingly Dark World of Rube Goldberg Machines at The Verge. Brendan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Rube Goldberg was primarily a cartoonist, I would have thought, an adult engineer. What's his story?
Cartooning was not necessarily the most lucrative or most assured career path, and engineering was a little bit more solid. So he went to engineering school and got a job working on the sewer system in San Francisco after he graduated. Lasted about 6 months, and then started working for newspapers doing sports cartooning.
He actually won a Pulitzer Prize for political cartooning as well. Really accomplished. So where did this idea come from for the machines that he is now famously known for?
He had a professor when he was at school who presented a thought experiment to the class to design a machine that could weigh the world. And Rube thought that this was just a ludicrous sort of thing. And that is sort of the genesis of the kind of, you know, convoluted technology that came to define our world, as he thought.
So he made these into cartoons. He just drew them.
Yes. Yeah. Rube never actually built one. I interviewed his granddaughter quite a few times. And one of the stories that she told me was that she has a memory of going to the beach with him as a child. And they had some kind of Playmobil set or something that they had to build, and he couldn't figure it out. Like he was completely useless as an actual engineer. So I don't know how much he made you actually pay attention in school.
So when did people start building these machines based on his drawings?
So in the 50s at Purdue University, there were two engineering fraternities that established a Rube Goldberg machine building contest. And there was a trophy that went back and forth between the frat houses. And that lasted for a couple of years. It sort of faded into memory until the early 80s when a pledge at one of the fraternities was dusting off the trophy case. And he came across the Rube Goldberg machine trophy, and he decided to start up the competition again. And after a few years, the Goldberg family found out about it and sort of took it national.
Although people may know them from a couple of different pop culture references, what are some of those that come to mind for you?
Probably the one that a lot of people are familiar with is the band OK Go had a music video a couple of years ago where their music video was built around a Rube Goldberg machine, but they pop up kind of all over the place.
Well, I think of these, you know, kind of things where a ball drops and goes down a chute and then falls onto a pinwheel that turns something else. You know, these kind of crazy, fun, wondrous thing. I'm not hearing the surprisingly dark world of Rube Goldberg here. What don't we know?
I mean, part of what interested me about this in the first place was that Rube Goldberg's original cartoons were drawn and conceived of in a lot of ways as a kind of critique of the proliferation of technology, of a kind of ideology that looks to technology as the source of all of our solutions to all of everyday problems, large and small. And in a lot of his cartoons, they get quite dark. And there are, I mean, there's one, it's a machine to facilitate a failed banker's suicide. Mm-hmm. It gets very dark. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting to me is how that critique has been sort of subsumed by the engineering for the sake of engineering, which is the kind of thought process that Rube himself was trying to satirize.
Well, Brendan, thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Brendan O'Connor, he's a writer and freelance journalist. He's based in New York, and we found his article, Inside the Surprisingly Dark World of Rube Goldberg Machines, at The Verge. There's a video of some of the machines at the College Nationals, as well as some really beautiful illustrations. You'll find a link to look at them at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can search for Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. Please come back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio. Just when you get on a roll, oh, here it goes, here it goes, here it goes again. Oh, here it goes again. I should've known, should've known.